Good morning, everybody, and welcome. It's Isabel McKenzie, Seniors Advocate for the Province of BC on the line, and I want to thank you for your interest in our latest report on resident-to-resident aggression in BC care homes. Some of you have been through this format before, but just to remind everybody of the process we will be going through, I will be using PowerPoint slides as part of my presentation, and I want to make sure that everyone on the phone line has an ability to access those slides as well as the report and the media release. Everybody can find them on the website at www.seniorsadvocatebc.ca. Again, that's seniorsadvocatebc.ca. If you go to that website, you will find on the lower left-hand side a box that's called Reports and Publications. And immediately under that, you will see Report, Resident-to-Resident Aggression in BC Care Homes, June 29, 2016. Click on that. And that will take you to a site where you will see three separate documents: the report, the news release, and the presentation. I'll just give everybody a few seconds to get to that site. So you can download the report if you wish. Anybody on the line who wants a printed copy sent to them is welcome to call my office and we will, or email my office and we will forward one to you. It's in a PDF form on the website. I would ask you, those who want to follow the presentation, to click on View the Presentation. And every time the slide advances, I will tell you to advance the slide on the presentation. My presentation is going to be about 30 minutes or so, and then we will open the floor to questions. I am aware that there are media on the line who are on deadlines, and so I would ask media to queue for their question now, and if they don't have a question at the end of the presentation, they can remove themselves from the queue. The way that you will put yourself in the queue for questions is to press 01 on the phone, and if you decide you do not have questions later, you press the number sign and it will remove you from the queue. And if the media could identify the name and the media outlet, that will allow us to get to your questions first. So then I would ask, as the presentation progresses or at the end, if any other of the listeners have questions, to follow the same process. Press 01, and you will be placed in the queue for your question. Also, just to remind everybody that this conference is being recorded and it will be uploaded to my office's website in the next day or so, and so you will be able to go back to it, or if you know folks who were unable to attend, they will be able to go online and listen to the conference. So I hope everybody now has the slides in front of them, and I will begin the presentation now. So I will ask you to move to slide one, which is labeled background. So the background to this report is that over the last 18 months, there's been increased public awareness of what we call resident-to-resident aggression in our care homes in British Columbia. In 2013, the provincial government changed regulations that allowed us to capture the type of incidents of resident-to-resident aggression. So changes were made to both the Community Care and Assisted Living Act and to the Hospital Act that required reporting. As a result of that, we were able to develop a year's worth of data across all facilities and actually conduct a systemic review of incidents looking for patterns or predictors. Slide two. So the objectives of our review were to examine the incidence of aggression between residents that resulted in harm to one or both of the residents, to look at the facilities where these incidents occurred, as well as the circumstances of the incidents themselves, and to identify where or if there were specific systemic patterns emerged that could reasonably predict these incidents were going to happen or were more likely to occur in either the makeup of the facility or the residents in terms of predicting that these incidents would occur. Slide three. So we found that there were some challenges in conducting this review. So even though in 2013 the province changed legislation to require reporting, we found that we still have some work to do on the reporting front. So I want to start off by identifying what some of these challenges are around the data that I'm going to be talking about in the report. The first thing to highlight is that residential care facilities in this province are governed by two separate regulatory frameworks. There's the Hospital Act, which in the slides will be referred to as HA, and the Community Care and Assisted Living Act, CCALA, as I will refer to it. This review looked at or examined 304 facilities, and of those 304 facilities, 204 are under CCALA, and 100 are under Hospital Act. And I want to be clear that both owned and operated and private facilities are under both frameworks. So there are private operators who are under the Hospital Act, and there are health authority owned and operated sites that are under CCALA. It's a bit of a mixed bag. The 204 facilities that are under CCALA report their incidents of resident-to-resident aggression to the licensing office, and this reporting is mandatory as per the regulations. The Hospital Act sites report through different streams depending on the health authority. These streams include reporting directly to the ministry under the Hospital Act incidents of serious harm, but it also includes reporting through the Patient Safety and Learning System, which is a voluntary reporting system and has a different degree of harm that they look at reporting. Move to slide four. So in addition to the different regulatory frameworks and the different reporting systems, there are also different definitions under CCALA and under the Hospital Act and under the Patient Safety Learning System. So under CCALA, for those 204 facilities, what gets reported is aggression between persons in care that results in injury requiring first aid, emergency treatment, or hospitalization. So it is possible in a CCALA site that there was an incident between two residents, but because there was no harm, no first aid administered, it would not be captured or reported as an incident of resident-to-resident aggression. Under the Hospital Act, which is the mandatory reporting requirement, it is a serious adverse event that leads to severe harm or death of a resident that is reported, and severe harm is defined as causing permanent or long-term changes to a person's quality of life and functioning, causes pain, requires major medical intervention, or leads to a shortened life expectancy. So it's a higher threshold for reporting under the Hospital Act, the mandatory reporting, than under CCALA. Under the Patient Safety and Learning System, which is where many of the Hospital Act facilities are reporting, we are requiring incidents to be reported whether they've resulted in minor, moderate, or severe harm or death. And so under the minor harm, which is the lowest threshold, it's not necessary that first aid be administered. But the reporting under the patient safety learning system is number one, voluntary, and number two, is only available to health authority owned and operated facilities. It's not available to privately owned facilities that are under the Hospital Act. So with that caveat of some of the limitations of the data that we have, I would ask you to move to slide five. And these are the parameters of the data that we examined. We looked at resident-to-resident incidents of aggression between April 1st, 2014 and March 31st, 2015. This is the first full year of data that we have subsequent to the changes to the regulations in 2013. The analysis of the incidents by facility characteristics, there were 331 reported incidents, excluding patient safety learning system incidents, and 58% of facilities overall reported no incidents. An analysis of individual incident reports included 422 discrete incidents because we were able to include the patient safety learning incidents. And the data were anonymized, so we were not tied when we looked at the individual incident to the facility incident. Move to slide six. So as background, this is a snapshot of some of the characteristics of people in care. We have very robust data under our RAI MDS reporting of the characteristics of people in care. We know much more about them than what is reflected in this snapshot here, but in terms of understanding the population that we're talking about for the purposes of resident-to-resident aggression, we've chosen to highlight these particular facts. So the average age, the average age is 85 years in our residential care facilities, but 56% of our seniors in care are actually over the age of 85. 65% are female. 61% have a diagnosis of an Alzheimer's or other type of dementia. 30% have a diagnosis of a psychiatric condition or mood disorder. And some of those people will also have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. 62% have moderate to severe cognitive or memory impairment. Just to remind people that it is possible that you would have moderate to severe cognitive or memory impairment and not have Alzheimer's. And that could be someone, for example, who has suffered a stroke or who has an acquired brain injury. 82% of our residents in care facilities have a combination of complex conditions indicating high or very high need for facility-level care. You would expect that. In fact, arguably, you would expect that number to be higher. 33% of our residents exhibit aggressive behaviors. And 51% received 9 or more medications in the last 7 days. So that just gives you a bit of a snapshot of the population that we are talking about when we're talking about our seniors in residential care. Slide seven. So the first thing is the facility level findings, in which we were able to look at 331 incidents. And what we were looking at here is what were the characteristics of the facilities, not the characteristics of the people, but the characteristics of the facilities where these incidents occurred. Well, first of all, the facilities tended to have a population with higher diagnoses of psychiatric disorders and aggression problems, higher instances of physical and verbal abuse. They had higher rates of antipsychotics. Their population had higher mobility and higher rates of independent walking. And so intuitively that makes some sense, because in order to be the aggressor, you need to have a certain amount of mobility and ability. that is perhaps a little higher than the population at large in that facility. Slide 8. We looked for patterns within the incidents to see if we could find some predictors. The first thing we looked at is, was there a particular time of day when the incident was more likely to occur? And the evidence would support that certainly between the hours of 4 p.m. and 8 p.m., which is 1600 to 2000, that's where we saw the biggest cluster, not the majority, but the biggest cluster of incidents. One of the challenges is that was the only time, that was the narrowest time frame we were able to establish for our increments. And any of you on the line who work in residential care will know there's a big difference between 1600 and 2000. There's arguably a big difference between 1600 and 1900, whether this is about going for dinner or whether this is about settling down after dinner. We can't really tease out because we don't know whether they happen smoothly over those 4 hours or whether they're clustered at one end of the 4 hour time increment. One of the challenges of the reporting system that we have. But one of the things it did show was that the majority of incidents certainly happen during daytime, which is, number one, when there is most activity in the facilities, but also when the staffing will be at its highest, less incidents in the evening and early morning hours. Slide 9. We looked at the incidents and the direct care hours, and what we found was that facilities with incidents tended to have residents with more complex care needs. That would, I think, be intuitively what we would think as well, and the data do support that. But the direct care hours in these facilities, and it's an average per resident, were slightly lower than the facilities with no incidents. So facilities with incidents had an average of 3.08 hours of care per resident per day, and the facilities with no incidents had an average of 3.13 hours of care per day per resident. But the facilities where these incidents happened had a more complex mix of residents than the facilities where it didn't happen. And so you would expect, in fact, for them to have higher care hours. And while the difference seems slight, and indeed in a small facility, it would be slight, if we take an 80-bed facility as an example, the difference between these direct funded care hours is a deficit of 4 hours of direct care a day or 182 fewer 8-hour shifts per year. And so one might argue that if we have higher incidents between 4 and 8 p.m., we could put it, if we were an 80-bed facility or more, we could have an extra staff person or more, depending on the number of beds, during that time period if we were providing the same number of direct hours of care as facilities where incidents didn't happen and who have lower complexity of clients. So it may suggest that facilities where residents have more complex care needs are not getting enough care hours to adequately handle the complexity of their clients. We don't, this is not a causal link, this is a correlation. Slide 10. We looked at the location of where the incidents occurred. As you can see, the majority of incidents did happen in public spaces. The single largest cluster, 35%, were in the individual residence room, followed by the dining hall, 31%, the hallway, 18%, the lounge area, outdoors, others and off-premises. You can see the percentages there. So again, it is the highest percentage is in residence rooms, but the majority actually happens outside residence rooms where there are other people and where there could be more staff. Slide 11. We looked as best we could at the characteristics of the aggressors in terms of their gender and age. This is, I would caution, imperfect data because the incident reports of harm are about the harm to the victim. Arguably, there are two victims in resident-to-resident aggression, but it doesn't always capture all of the information about the aggressor. But from the information that we had, what we were able to find is that disproportionately the aggressors were male because they are only 35% of the population, but they were a higher percentage of the aggressors, and they tended to be slightly younger and slightly more mobile. And I think all of those would be intuitively what we would think as well. Move to slide 12. The characteristics of the victim. For this, we had more complete data because the incident report is triggered by the harm done to the victim. And again, overwhelmingly female, older, less mobile. Exactly what your instincts would tell you is supported by the data. So move to slide 13. So once we looked at this data, and there's much more outlined in the report, which what I would encourage everybody to read in more detail, what are some of the mitigation strategies that we find in our facilities? So secure units and alarm systems. And it's outlined in the report. A significant number of our facilities do have that. Technology to monitor residents' movements, secured indoor-outdoor walking circuits, low-stimulant rooms. This is part of the strategy to diffuse agitation amongst dementia population, the snoozle-in rooms, the low-stimulant rooms where people are able to go and the sensory overload that they may be experiencing in the common areas where there are many people can be diffused, and PIECES training for dementia. And this is PIECES training. It's one module. It's the one that the provincial government has put forward as the standard. There are others. And the basic premise of the training is that the staff, the care aides, the nursing staff, are educated and trained into the methods that they can use to work with agitated populations to diffuse agitation. Part of this training is also around reducing the use of medications and using alternative therapies. And this is some of the literature would support that these are all very effective in diffusing the agitations that would lead to resident-to-resident aggression. So, slide 14. What are the recommendations of my office coming from this study? Well, the first recommendation is that we need better, more consistent, and comparable data if we are going to look for, do a deeper dive in terms of what are some of the systemic patterns across the various facilities. And so we are recommending that we develop, first of all, a consistent definition of what resident-to-resident aggression incident constitutes and what constitutes a reporting of that incident, and then a province-wide process to track not only the incidents but their follow-up. So although we are able to report on the incidents in this report imperfectly, but we are able to report, we can't report the follow-up because there is no systemic follow-up process either in CICALA or Hospital Act sites. We also recommend a review of the adequacy of staffing for residents with more complex needs, specifically during the busy hours like dinner hours. Now, this report started quite some time ago, and subsequent to when we started this report, indeed, the Minister of Health has called for a review of care hours, and he did this in April 2016 in response to our Quick Facts directory, which highlighted, amongst many other things, how many direct hours of care were funded for each facility, and demonstrated that I think it was 82% of our facilities were not at the recommended guideline of the average for the facility of 3.36 hours. And so that review is already underway. And we would just add to that that when we are looking at our funded hours of care, and we're looking at how we're going to distribute those hours over the course of the day, we look at this time frame of 4 to 8 p.m. and see if we can be staffed a little more effectively during that time. Hopefully, if we would be able to narrow down the time of these incidents to a little bit better accuracy than the four-hour window as well. We're recommending more education for staff and management to ensure that they report and address resident-to-resident incidents comprehensively. I know there is some thinking that the number of incidents are underreported, so context is important. We have 27,000 residents in residential care, and at the end of the day, there were, it would appear, 442 incidents that resulted in harm, a very small percentage. I think that the threshold of requiring first aid is a fairly definable threshold that leads to the reporting, and I would like to think that my professional colleagues in residential care would be reporting, and I think we just need to ensure that we emphasize the importance of this reporting, because we cannot fix problems without knowing as much as we can about those problems. And so I hope that this report and the attention people are now paying to this issue will be a catalyst to make sure that we indeed are reporting it. And if we can add to that a standardized reporting by facility across the province, I think we will be very well positioned to make even further advancements on this issue. We're also recommending facility design features that are known to be effective in mitigating aggressive behaviors, including the use of locking systems for private rooms to mitigate wandering behaviors be used. One of the things that the study found, I think some people, myself included actually, expected to find more incidents happening in rooms with multiple residents. Indeed, that wasn't the case. The majority of incidents happened in private, that did happen in rooms, happened in private rooms. And indeed, the majority of rooms in the system are private rooms. I think it's about 75% of our facilities actually do have private rooms. And so we need to look at whether different facilities are experimenting with this, and if we are able to get better reporting systems, we could perhaps do some studies to look at the efficacy of having the residents able to lock the room, so that if you're inside the room and you're the resident, it's locked. Care staff obviously swipe cards to get into the room, but it would prevent other people from wandering into the room. We can probably do some more work on that. So slide 15. I want to give special thanks here to health authorities, to the patient safety learning system teams, to the residential care facilities that took the time to respond to our survey, and to the Ministry of Health staff that have also supported this study and provided us with information. You know, none of this, these studies and the work of this office is possible without what I continue to be inspired by, full cooperation from those who are caring for our seniors in this province, and arguably our residential care facilities are caring for our most frail and vulnerable seniors. So I want to thank you all for that, if you're on the line, and for those of you who are from the public on the line, please know that those who are providing the care are just as interested as this office is in finding a way to reduce as much as possible resident-to-resident aggression. So with that, I will conclude my remarks. And I will open the phone lines to any questions. A reminder, if you have a question, you queue up by pressing 01 on your phone, and you will be placed in the queue to ask your question. So.
Thank you. The first question is from Angelo Iacobucci from CHNL Radio. Please go ahead, Angelo.
Thank you. Isabel, I had three separate questions. First of all, would you describe in general that the report contains some shocking results?
No. Actually, Angelo, I would not say the report contains shocking results. I would say the report highlights the need to do a better we need to standardize the reporting systems and align them better between Hospital Act sites and CECALA sites, number one. Number two, I think we do need to continue this focus on direct care hours. It does, this report supports that those facilities with incidents had marginally fewer direct care hours on average than the facilities without, yet they had a more complex population. I think we know there's an issue with the direct care hours. And I think we need to keep in mind that the majority of facilities, actually there were no incidents.
Number two, I think I'm just sort of going through the report quickly here. 20 incidents were at one particular facility. Can you tell me the name of the facility and which health authority that is in?
It is in Vancouver Coastal Health Authority, and the name of the facility, I'm going to get my notes here. It's the Kiwanis Care Center, which is owned and operated by Vancouver Coastal Health Authority. And it is under the CECALA legislation. So it has, the CECALA sites have the clearest reporting mechanism and a lower threshold of reporting than Hospital Act facilities. I would caution around drawing a negative inference because of this, Angelo. You need to examine the actual population in that care facility and before we can draw conclusions around why there were 20 incidents.
Okay. The last question, out of the 422 incidents in fiscal 14-15, how many were fatalities?
I believe there was one fatality. But I want to emphasize, and I want to emphasize that in the frail seniors population, any incident that results in a harm that requires first aid, something as simple as being knocked to the floor and maybe requiring a Band-Aid that you or I may be able to brush off and continue on. In this population, that incident takes on a much, much higher magnitude of potential severity. So I view any incident that results in the administration of first aid for this particular population as potentially very serious.
Awesome. I appreciate your time. Thanks very much, Isabel.
Thank you, Angela.
Thank you, Angela. The next question is from Richard Zuzman from CBC Victoria. Please go ahead, Richard.
Isabel, is there any sense of what the procedures are now to deal with these sort of aggressive acts and how they vary from care home to care home?
The short answer, Richard, is we don't have robust systematic information to give anything other than an answer based on anecdotal observations and reports. So we know that in some facilities, some folks are employing the strategies of gentle persuasion and pieces with a greater degree of either enthusiasm or frequency of application than other facilities. We know that the use of antipsychotic medications varies from facility to facility. Higher use of antipsychotics, actually, in facilities where these incidents occurred. And so you want to question whether that's effective, because theoretically you're administering the antipsychotics to, in fact, deal with some of these behaviors, appears not to be effective. But difficult to give a really informed answer on that.
And is there any sense then of what training would consist of, if it's hard to understand what's being done now?
Well, there are very specific training programs, gentle persuasion pieces as examples, and in the report you will find that we have outlined how many facilities have undertaken this training. It's not 100%. So obviously we could be doing more training. There's deeper diving questions on the training. So a facility can report staff have been trained, but the next question is how many staff have been trained? And are they the staff that are only on during the day? Are they, you can see where we're going here, that there's still much more, information we need to know. But clearly there is room for more training of staff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. The next question is from Sharon Elston from infonews.ca. Please go ahead, Sharon.
Hi, Isabel. How are you today?
Well, thank you, Sharon.
I was just wondering, Isabel, we in our area that we cover in the interior, we've had a couple of incidents more on the serious end of resident-to-resident aggression where residents have died as a result. There was one in Vernon where a war veteran attacked his roommate, and another in Kamloops where a resident was also attacked and died as a result of his injuries. I was just wondering if you can speak specifically to those cases at all and how they fit into this particular report.
Well, the incidents, Sharon, if they, I'm sorry I missed the exact time frame, but if the incident happened in the time frame that we examined, they will be included in the data, but they are two incidents out of 422. I think, as I said previously, obviously, a death that results from the harm of a incident of resident-to-resident aggression is a very traumatic experience for everybody. I think we can all agree on that it's traumatic for the aggressor and their family as it is traumatic for the victim and their family. If we only focused on death, frankly, there's not enough to develop any kind of pattern. And so that's why we said we need to look at the incidents, and we have to assume that any incident could potentially result in exactly the kind of fatalities that we have seen because of the physical frailty of this population. So other than that, I don't want to get into the specifics of those two cases. I am aware of them. But there will be some, there could be some unique things in those cases. I think we need to look systematically at where the incidents are occurring and what it is we can do. You know, one of the things, one of the cautions, and any of you on the line who work in residential care will know this, that we, at the end of the day, even if we have done everything we possibly can, and we certainly do not know that we're at that place yet, but even when we've done absolutely everything that we can, it is still possible that an incident will occur. And I would caution anybody who believes somebody that can promise it never will. It is a reality of the population that we deal with, and we want to be we have some very fundamental philosophical questions to ask about the trade-offs we are going to have in residential care. If you wanted to reduce the possibility of this happening to zero, everybody would be in their room alone all the time. The minute you have communal living with folks, the potential for this to happen will be there. Our job is to ensure that we have done everything possible to mitigate that risk to as close to zero as we can.
Thank you, Sharon. The next question is from Kim Pemberton from Vancouver Sun. Please go ahead, Kim.
Hi, Isabel. Just furthering, following up on that other question about the deaths of resident on resident aggression, we've had 4 deaths per year in the past 4 years in BC, yet no coroner's recommendations or inquire into any of these. And so I'm wondering, is there a role for the seniors advocate to further examine the specific cases of resident aggression resulting in death?
So, Kim, we have had actually discussions with the coroner's office, and we actually have looked at it initially. I know this is going to sound odd, but there aren't enough deaths for us to confidently draw any inferences for a pattern, if you follow me. You can look at an individual case and see what mitigation strategies there might be for that individual case. We've taken it, those deaths actually were the catalyst for this report. So what we decided to do was, as I've said, we took the approach that every incident was a potential fatality. Sounds dramatic, I know, but I stand by that for this particular frailty of population. So what we're saying is, in this report, look, there's some evidence to support that there could be a link between the direct care hours and the occurring of an incident. There appears to be a time of day pattern, although it's not as narrow a time of day as we really need it to be. There appears to be a pattern in the profile of person likely to be an aggressor. There appears to be a pattern of some mitigation strategies. And it's an initial finding. This is not the end of this issue, of looking at this issue of this or of this discussion, because part of it is we need to address these different reporting systems and all the rest of it. But we are still in conversation with the coroner. We're going to be using this data and then going back and looking at these deaths and see how they fit, if they fit with these systemic patterns that we've identified. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Well, just following up on that, when you say you've had discussions with the coroner's office, does any of those discussions concern why they didn't in the past hold an inquest into any of these 12 deaths? That strikes me as odd, and I'm just wondering your view of that.
You raise a good point, Kim, and the frank answer is that wasn't part of the discussion. Mm-hmm. And it is a good question on your part as to why not, and I'm going to think about that.
Thanks.
Thank you, Kim. There are no further questions from the media at this time. We do have a question from Elizabeth Dow from Dow Consulting. Please go ahead, Elizabeth.
Hello, Isabel.
Hello, Elizabeth.
Yeah. Hello. I just wanted to ask a question, Isabel. I was wondering, in terms of further in-depth statistical analysis of the data that you've collected, if you're planning on looking at some of the factors, for example, I was thinking about the apparent high rate of number of medications, also linked with severity or vulnerability, and in terms of staff training? Like there could be a number of factors that you would look to analyze in a more complex way. And I'm wondering if there's plans for that. And I'm also was thinking in terms of the definition. The World Health definition is one that's been sort of used a fair amount too. So I'm just thinking in terms of the consistency across several of the studies that have been done nationally and using some of that information, and then also looking at that in the analysis of the rich data that you've collected. So that was one question. I had another one too.
So Elizabeth, I think the short answer to your question is I would like to do further analysis.
Yeah.
My preference would be to do it on more consistent data. And so, as I said, we want to move to a standardized, number one, definition of what constitutes abuse. A standardized definition of what constitutes resident-to-resident aggression as a reportable incident. We want to see, once that definition is standardized, we want to see the reporting processes standardized, including follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And once we have that, we can more reliably look at all 300-odd facilities in the province. In the absence of that, we can only look at the 204 CICALA sites. And we could do that. I would like to see a narrowing of the time pattern, because I think there's potentially some things there. And then we're challenged in our data at the moment, Elizabeth, in being able to link back some of the incidents to we know more about the victim than we do about the aggressor.
Yeah.
So I have lots of the RI profile, because the incident report obviously has the name of the victim. It does not always have the name of the aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of what are the characteristics of the person who's going to exhibit the aggression, we are limited with our with the current way it's reported. We're limited.
Okay. Would you also suggest that there might be a need for all facilities in the assessment process to really delve into identifying whether there had been abusive behaviors in the past to possibly identify risk factors?
Yes. Now, if we simply make it standardized, Elizabeth, that when there's a resident-to-resident aggression report, that we have standardized the expectation that the aggressor, we have that profile, we will have all that information on them. Problem is, the reporting system is imperfect, and we can't draw those inferences. But I agree that that is very valuable information to have. And we have it about the victim,
yeah,
not about the aggressor, necessarily.
Yeah. Okay. May I have one more question?
Yeah.
I also was just thinking about, I realize and appreciate that you're keeping confidential the names of the, you know, the recipients and of the aggressors and the victims of the aggression. And I'm also thinking about sort of an ethical dilemma that could occur with the need for really examining all the data and the facilities, because I'm thinking with naming facilities, I would just be concerned that people might close down and be afraid to sort of put things out, or it may raise extra anxiety amongst the residents of a facility if they're hearing information but don't know if it's their facility or another facility. So I'm just sensitive to that issue and wondered if you had any comment.
Yeah, it's a good question, Elizabeth. And, you know, this is the dilemma. The public, seniors and their family and the public have clearly said we want to know what's happening in our residential care facilities. And so we published our Quick Facts directory. It was following up, I think, on something that the ombudsperson had been advocating should be out there. And so the information is out there. People have to view that information responsibly. I actually have a great degree of confidence in people to look at information and to judge it responsibly. So incidents are related to number of beds. There can be caveats if they have a highly aggressive population in a particular secure unit within the facility, all of these kinds of things. But at the end of the day, it is possible that people will say, oh, that's a terrible facility. They have all these incidents of resident-to-resident aggression. I don't think that will happen. I think we will be able to explain if there are anomalies. And then the other thing is, if there are facilities where there are high incidents and we actually find that they aren't employing some of the mitigation strategies, that's helpful. You know, I'm not saying that that's what will be found, but the individual person, the data are all anonymized. I don't know. Nobody knows who the person is. We get a number. We don't get a name. And the threshold is generally facilities with less than five beds aren't reported on because it risks identifying people. And I think we may have even raised that threshold to 10 for certain things. But, you know, at the end of the day, no good deed goes unpunished and no as we move forward in our transparency and democratization of information about what's happening in residential care, these are the things that will happen.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your report, Isabel. It's really welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And we have one more question that just queued up. This one is from Cindy Harnett from the Times Columnist. Please go ahead.
Hello, Isabel. I just wanted to go back to the last report that you did. And can you remind me how many facilities did not meet the recommendation of the 3.36 hours of care per senior every day?
Well, the first thing that I'm going to get, it's apparently a guideline of 3.36 average hours in a facility. But Cindy, it was 82% didn't meet the guideline of 3.36. And I have to be honest and say I was surprised at that.
So given that, can you then put in perspective the need for increased staffing hours? How great a part does that play in the recommendations? I hear that consistent reporting seems like first and foremost to get the right numbers. But after that, does care hours come up as probably the most significant factor?
It's hard to say, Cindy, if it's the most significant. But what is clear to say is this. We examined those facilities that had incidents and those facilities that didn't. The facilities that had incidents had marginally fewer hours of care, but more complex clients than the facilities where incidents did not occur. It's this old causation correlation business, right?
Mm-hmm.
So can I categorically state that increasing the care hours would have reduced the number of incidents? I can't responsibly say that. I can say that a pattern showed where it's, and you have to view the two together. It's not just that the care hours were marginally less. The population was also more complex.
Okay.
Right? So if you want to follow the logic that says care hours are decided and vary because of complexity of clients, actually, that argument's not supported by what we found in this study. This study found that, in fact, the more complex care facilities had fewer hours.
And going forward, obviously we know that the minister is studying this now. Given all that we hear about, you know, the demographics and an aging population, is this something we should be, the report that you have here now and in January, be very concerned about going into the future in terms of an aging population?
Yes, although, frankly, you know, I would argue even if the population wasn't increasing, the issue is our most frail and vulnerable seniors are in residential licensed care. They've surrendered significant liberties in exchange for safety. That's what you do in residential care. We are guaranteeing certain things. We need to make sure that we've done everything we can to make you as safe as possible. It'll never be 100%, but as safe as possible. There's a whole bunch of things that can affect your safety. But falling victim to a fellow resident, we should be mitigating this. It's true. It's not just that the population's increasing, Cindy. It is true that the population entering residential care now is older, more likely to have a dementia, and more likely to have an aggressive behavior than the population that entered residential care 25 years ago. And so I think that that's why we're starting to hear about this and be concerned about this.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Cindy. And we have one more question, this time from Donna Ellis from Kin Village. Please go ahead, Donna.
Hi, Isabel. My question is a bit of a follow-up to that one. Could you say anything about how you define or measure residents with more complex care needs?
Yes, we're using the RI assessment data for that, Donna. So I think we're using I think it's in the report, but we're probably using something like ADLs 3 and more, CPS of 3 and more, combined with aggressive behaviors. We're probably using MAPLE 4s and 5s. That's how we're using it from the RI data.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Donna. There are no further questions at this time.
Well, I want to say, I'm not sure how many of you are out there, but however many of you there are, I want to thank you very much for your interest in this subject and to encourage you to read the full report, to encourage you to remember that although I've used the term victim and aggressor to differentiate, really this is an issue where there really are two victims when these incidents occur, and that I hope that this report, which I do not see as a definitive report. I do not see it as providing the aha moment I had hoped we might be able to provide, that if we only did this, then we could significantly reduce it. I think it hopefully will be a catalyst for more work, and that we will be able to go back and examine this issue in more detail. I certainly take to heart some of the questions and comments, and I certainly take to heart the comment about going back and having another conversation with the coroner, and we will do that and report back to you. And I encourage any of you, if you have any questions after you get off the line or want to ask my office directly about this report, please do so. So thank you very much.